pleasure today to have Jason Pollock. Hello, Scott. Those Einstein conversations is good for the next matter. All right.
Oh, what? It's a title. David probably don't remember. It's invented by David Gross. He asked me to give a talk on the Blackboard lunch a month ago. Unfortunately, when I prepared the talk, I forgot the Blackboard lunch. At that time, I thought the general talk that I've been giving in the last year and a half would maybe be appropriate. And the talk was, in a way, a response to some of the skepticisms of my condensed matter colleagues who wonders what truly new things one can learn from dilute Bose gas. After all, it's a subject that is in many textbooks and has been studied for a lot in the intervening years. What attracted me to this field has been to uncover what the aspects of these systems that are truly different from the familiar helium-4 bosons, and the kind of and the truly new things that we have never seen before. As I study more, then I'm more convinced that the activities in BEC in the last 2 years is merely the beginning of something remarkable, and even with all this current excitement, the best is yet to come, and in my opinion, we have seen nothing yet. And that's the way that I respond to my condensed matter colleagues is to offer them some evidence to substantiate these points, and in the process, I'll also try to convince them that it is a subject of, well, with charm and beauty from top to bottom. So when I was preparing this talk, I discovered there's another problem. My audience here would be, well, at the moment, IDP is invaded by string theorists, and they may not even care about what condensed matter nor BEC. Well, neither we care about either condensed matter nor BEC. Probably the only time they have the concern about BEC is to beat the BEC team in the football game in the picnic. And it might even be true that the view on condensed matter or they view condensed matter with the same skepticism as my condensed matter colleagues view BEC. So I think what I should first do is to say a few words about condensed matter. I'd like to give them some examples to illustrate the kind of problem that my condensed matter colleagues are obsessed with, and I believe that in the process, they would discover some common themes. And after that, I will come back to explain how the BEC research will help us to tackle some of the problems that the condensed matter people are obsessed with, and also the many new dimensions that it has opened up. Now, I know that this, I've forgotten that it's a Blackboard lunch, but then if you allow me, there's something that is impossible to do it on a Blackboard. And so that is the description of a small corner of condensed matter.
Oops.
Yes, and then you discover it's like this. If you look at the web, every day there are about 70% of the papers on condensed matter is on these subjects, and these subjects are interconnected with one another, and that is essentially the nature of condensed matter. They are all connected to one another, and for example, the topic of quantum Hall is to me is a subject of astounding beauty, and it's an incompressible fluid, and then the whole thing is what the bulk of the fluid is supposed to describe by some transcendent theory, and then but then because it's incompressible, so all the dynamics are on the edge, and the edge is, turns out to be described as some conformal field theory, and conformal field theory connected to the multi-channel Kondo problem, as Andre Ludwig, unfortunately he's not here, will tell you, and the multi-channel is also connected to heavy fermion, and they share some common properties of non-fermi liquid with high TC non-fermi liquid behaviors, and high TC and the quantum Hall has a is believed to have close connections in the aspects that the dynamical system somehow generate just by itself a lot of fluctuating gauge fields. So there are a lot of studies in fluctuating gauge fields with fermions and bosons, and so on and so forth. Eventually, it connected up to BEC. It's a very remote connection at this point. And what I'm trying to show later in the talk is that there is, in fact, a lot of connections. And it could fill up a lot of connections in the future. Not only in the future, probably in the near future. If you look at, well, you would say, well, what a bloody mess. When there's a whole, there's multiple connected things. However, if you look at it more carefully, and then there's a common class of problem that the condensed matter physicists are very interested in. And it's always, often, well, it's often about these class of problems, i.e., either systems that has infinite number of degrees of freedom, or systems have no scales. For example, and in fact, most of the problems that I mentioned last in the last few graphs are the problem with no energy scales. For example, you take the Heisenberg model. Everyone knows that it's J times Si dot Sj, and you take J may as well set it to 1, and there's no small parameter, no nothing, and then you cannot expand around any known ground states, and you have to tackle the problem head on. The same as quantum Hall systems, that you have a so-called degenerate Landau level, and all the kinetic energies are frozen out. And one to start with, at the first step, is a system which completely degenerate, again has no small parameters. And the same with TJ model, and then now in fact the solution of TJ model is by TJ model is the. It's a model that you can think of as electrons with spin up and down, hopping on a lattice, and there's a very important condition that two electrons cannot sit on top of one another, and that's the so-called the condition of no double occupancy, and that generates all the complications. And the solution of this model, so-called T model, just the electron hopping around without allowing to sit on top of one another, is no easier than the so-called TJ model, which is you turn on a little bit coupling to allow them to couple magnetically. And the T model is one of the illustration that the system again has no energy scales. So it is the card. And these class of problems are the problem that occupies the attention of condensed matter physicists for the last decade. And often the condensed matter physicists are not tackling with one or two phenomena. They have to tackle with a whole set of phenomena. For those of you who are not in high TC, you don't have to look at this, but for those with high TC or in condensed matter, and then there's something that many of you probably very well know very well, and that in high TC, then we have a whole range of phenomena as a function of doping, and then if you don't put electrons in it, you have an anti-fermion magnet. When you put electrons in it, you get a big Fermi surface, and then you have to figure out how the Fermi surface gets destroyed, and then you have to have a theory that you build up the so-called pseudo-gap in the high TC regime, and then you have to explain high TC and why the high TC varies so much for different materials, and then on top of it, you have to explain the so-called confinement in the C-axis and then how the D-wave superconductivity come about. And afterwards, then still you're facing the problem, you have to explain the very prominent magnetic excitations in the superconducting states. And then a successful theory, what condensed matter theory is typically looking for is a simple theory to explain all these things. And it is still, of course, a problem of great struggle. Now, and often, there's another problem that the atomic condensed matter physicists is facing, which is often the system, is technically difficult. often it's also plagued by the system we are interested in, also plagued by the quality of the sample, and we do not have good data and sufficiently turn over time for experiments to give us enough experimental information. Of course, the number of experimental data compare the ratio of experimental data in condensed matter versus string theory cannot be bigger. But it would, of course, be very nice that we could have a situation where we have lots of experimental turnover time, and then we can do experiments very quickly. And that is, in fact, why the helium-3 the problem was solved so quickly, and because that is a system which is so pure, and then the accuracy of experimental data in the ultra-low temperature experiments are legendary. And then because the one was able to get very accurate data, the one was able to uncover, to unlock the mystery of various phases very quickly. I think that's where one of the areas that BEC can really help the condensed matter in the future. I was in Jella a few months ago, and I at that time Eric Cornell tried to show me the experiments. It didn't work. That day just happened, didn't work. And then he said, however, when it works, you can do experiment 200 times in a day. Now, a typical low temperature experiment takes several months to do, if you're lucky. And if you so 30 days a month, and then how many hours a day, and then we're talking about a factor of 10 to the 5th to 10 to the 4th. And then if the student group off and the experiment doesn't work 1 hour 10 times, you're still talking about a factor of 500 error, and then we are talking about a difference, a factor of 20. So in effect, when you're talking about compressing 20 years experiments into 1 year, and I think that lies the power of the BEC experiment, and then the high attempt frequency that is capable in these experiments. Now, what can BEC do for the condensed matter? So far, it has enabled us to make very quantitative comparison between theoretical experiments, and has forced us to for those in the workshop to face some of the fundamental problems that has been swept under the rug for a long time. And for example, one of the current issues is that whether some of the simplest structure, topological structure, we believe to be correct in this system. So the vortex structure is in fact the right structure, and then so that's still a subject of a great discussion. And this point I've made before, that it's possible to do experiments with a very great turnover time. But I think what I find truly exciting is that as we shall discuss in a minute, I think that the BEC type of experiments allow us to produce many systems which are of great interest in condensed matter. And in fact, and because of these capabilities, one is probably would be able to produce a lot of more data in the future to test out some of these the physics of these, to find out the physics of these systems, and such as hybrid model and TJ model, Condor, etc. And then I think in a minute you will see that there would be it's very easy to have all these analogs in the BEC setting. On top of it, I think there's another aspect of this system which I find very interesting, and it offers us opportunity to study a brand new world, and it is a world that's made of particles with large spins. Just imagine that now, instead of having electrons and bosons of the ordinary type, just imagine the electron has spin 7/2. And then how would the Cooper pair form? Do you have a spin 7/2? And then think of the electron phonon systems. Instead of having electrons and phonons, ordinary electron phonons, you have both electrons and phonons have large spins. And then now you have now you're asked to study the physics of these systems. I understand it's blackboard lunch and I'm supposed to use the blackboard, but I have two more view graphs and then I will follow your wish. I will continue the blackboard. But then, because it's the nature of the connection of these topics, it's very hard to write on the blackboard. Here is what I think BC looks like, and that's something that's happening, and then I think this what is down here is what I think what will happen in the future. There are a lot of motivation to study the DC experiments, and then there are motivations from position measurement and quantum optics, and then there are a lot of efforts in making a laser application device such as atom laser. And then Peter Zola has recently pointed out that it might be used to, or some version of, it might have some connection with the quantum computation. He has, I'll continue a little bit later. But the kind of the connection to the condensed matter are listed below. The kind of quantum system that we have, we can have one type of bosons, and then have we can have a mixture of bosons, a mixture of boson and fermions, and fermion fermions, etc. And then a mixture of boson fermion would be the analog of electron phonon systems in condensed matter. And all these systems can be put in different kind of traps, and different kind of traps basically release different kinds of degrees of freedom. And then you have some kind of traps which I call has to make the system look like a U1 system, and there are different kinds of traps which looks like more the rotational invariant systems. And these traps are not fantasies. In fact, many of the optical trap has in fact been produced a few months ago at the MIT group. And then one can very easily to produce a 3 and 2 and 1 dimensional setting. And one can have a single trap, or one can, and Peter Zola recently have studied what happened if you turn on a so-called optical lattice in both Einstein condensation systems. And it's a very interesting situation. For example, a typical post condensate would have 10 to the 12 particles per centimeter, and then cube. And then, so if you put it in a box, and then you say what's the wavelength for one particle, and then you only need to the 10 to the minus 4 centimeters, which is typical the wavelength of a laser. So by turning on the optical lattice, one can produce a lattice, and where the boson can hop from side to side. But then on the other hand, the boson doesn't like to sit on top of one another. So that's so-called boson Hubbard model. And Peter has and his team has done some very nice studies and about the phase diagrams of these systems. And he has posted a number of very nice photographs at his store, and then you are invited to go and look at it. Now, but you don't have to stop there. When that means that now you can put a fermion in the systems, and then you can have put the bosons with very large spins. And it turns out these bosons have very large spins. And then, or you can create a potential at any particular site, and then go into the so-called mixed valence regimes in solid state physics, and then you can produce quantum model, etc. So there's a whole range of phenomena in condensed matter that can be produced in these settings. Of course, we are not dealing with 10 to the 23 particles, but we are dealing with 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 6 particles. And it's pretty good already. So my plan is the following, that two more and I use blackboard. I'm not taking up too much of the time. But I just want to tell you that I'd like to tell you that some of the simple and which I believe are interesting physics for systems with of bosons with very large spins and systems of fermions with large spins. And in the case of large spin bosons, I would show you that, for example, you can see the Berry's phase effect, and you can see the nucleation of skermions. And then in the case of large spin fermion systems, and there's a very curious phenomenon I would like to tell my condensed matter colleagues. The nature of pairing depends on the spin that participate in the pairs, and there's a phase transition. There's a very different different type of pairing as you change the spin of the pairs, which I'll come to in a minute. So that's the that would be the rest of the talk. One more, as I say, again, you don't need to look at anything except the last column. All I want to say is that these are objects with a very big spins, and where does the spin come from? The spin comes from counting up everything, electrons and then protons, neutrons, and everything, and then they allow them to interact as much as they want through the hyperfine interaction and whatnot, and then eventually they would settle down to two multiplets, and then the so-called high superfine spin multiplets, and then these are the ultimate configuration. They settle down and they can have, like for example, some of them have five spin, some of them are fermions with the spin 5½, and then or spin 3½, or bosons with spin 4 and 3, and then 1 and 2, etc. So there's a kind of variety that we have. Am I supposed to? I talk about the boson, fermion, large spins, and I will stop. But before I tell you, it's boson, fermion, large spins, and or the kind of simple models that one has, and I have to give some very brief introduction of what is going. So what is being used to describe this system these days? First, I want to talk about the so-called magnetic traps. The magnetic trap is, so you take a particle, say one of these atoms, and which has spins, and you apply a field, and then say suppose it's spin 1, and the atomic physics notation, instead of calling it S or J, they call it F for some reason. That's part of. So spin 1, and then they split up in, so there's some Zeeman energy due to this is the magnetic moment. Now, in case you have a field B, because the function of R, which looks something like this, and then this energy, which you can regard as a potential, would go like this as a function of R, and then you have a confining potential, and the rest of them are deconfining. And then so what is being trapped is the most energetic stuff in these potentials. And then, for example, if you have a field like this, this is magnetic field B, and then the boson, which is this is 0, 1, 1, 0, minus 1, would have a spin direction pointing in this direction, and then there's a particle degrees of freedom describing by this field. Now this in this setting, this is completely frozen because all aligned in this direction, and this is all frozen to be 0, 0, 1. And of course there's no such thing in reality, because you cannot have a field look like this, but the field has to satisfy Maxwell equations, then you cannot have curl free and divergence free and look something like this. So what happens is that the field has a little bit, it has some small variations, and it is necessary to satisfy the Maxwell equation. So in reality, then this spinner actually has a quantization axis, which is slightly varying in real space, and it is, and. But still, the magnetic degrees is still frozen, and then what is left is this particle degrees of freedom. And the Hamiltonian, and that one has, is a very simple Hamiltonian, which is the describing the propagation of particle degrees of freedom is trapped by the potential, and then so the system self-interacts. So the low energy theory looks something like this, that so you have lambda 5-4 theory, essentially. Of this form, and that has been the Hamiltonian that is used to describe the behavior of the bosons in magnetic traps. And then about a few months ago, in December, there's a paper at MIT came out in the web, and they was able to talk about to trap everything in optical traps. This is important. Especially from my viewpoint, is that. That makes all the difference, because this object, we could have a brand new condensate, brand new quantum systems, if this is not frozen, because then we would have for the first time has a Bose condensate where you have a true spinner field. Now what the optical trap does is that it releases this spin degrees of freedom. And how does it release spin degrees of freedom? So if you apply a field which is oscillating, and then it generates dipole moment P, and then the P is usually proportional to the E, and then you have a potential energy which is minus one half of E squared. So if you have a field, looks something like this, field profile, and then it will generate a potential energy U which looks something like this. And this acts on the three. Suppose I have spin one, F is to one, and act on the M equals to 1, 0, -1, more or less the same. And so as a result, then one has now a system which is spin rotational invariance. You have a field U which so act on all the spins in the same way, and then now you have interactions. And then what kind of interaction that you have? And now there's a little bit just for the atomic physicists. There's a little like usually there are two multiplets, F equals to two, F equals to two and F equals to one, for example. And what happened is that the energy separation is a gigahertz. So what happens is that if you start with a lower multiplet, you're always locked in the lower multiplet. So what happens is that you are dealing with the systems which is locked in this multiplet, and then you just need to classify all the interaction that has been rotational invariance. And then there's a very simple term that you can write down. You can write down something that's this is a rotational invariance, and this is one of them. This is density of coupling. And then you can also, of course, then you have a coupling of this form. And that turns out that the most general form for spin 1. Now for spin 2, then one has similar term, but then with a and then spin 3, so on and so forth, you can have more of these objects, and that's a general structure. But now, let me then just focus on the situation of a spin 1. And we don't need to solve this problem in great detail. You can extract a lot of information just by just looking at it. For example, this interaction is just saying that I have a density interaction, 0. If you look at the first quantized form. And then I have a spin interaction. If this be Hamiltonian for two particles. Now, so all the spin interaction is in here. And if this coefficient turns out to be negative, then I would have a quantum ferrum, I would have a ferrum magnet, because then all the spins like to line up. Now, if I spin one, then the ferrum magnet would be that I would have a spinner like this, so that would be my ferrum magnet. And so let me now just, of course, if it's positive, then the system would condense another phase. But now let me use the quantum ferromagnet case to illustrate some of the interesting physics. And I will not have time to talk about the other case. Let me talk about the case G1 is negative, and then I have a condensed state, and there where the magnitude is just the density, and then the system condenses into something like this. Now, here you immediately discover there's something very weird about this state, i.e., the system is about spin rotational invariance. So if I multiply this by a phase factor, by a gauge transformation, I can always undo it by a local spin off rotation. And so there's a equivalence between the gauge and the spin rotations, and that turns out that has an important physical consequence. And the important physical consequence is the following: that now just let me just tell you what the phenomena is, because one can exchange the O4 gauge motion with the spin rotation. So suppose you have a cloud like this. Initially, nothing is rotating, but now you begin to spin the whole thing, it will develop it's going to be on. Or follow, the whole thing will stand out in the follower like this. There's something on the rotation. And the reason for that is that the system would like to trade off some of these, some of the energies in this part by with the energy of this part. And the, how does it come about? It comes about as follows. Let me just bear with me in a minute. So if you have a, let me just go back to the good old Schrodinger description. You have a rotating system, then you have a system is in rotation. Where this is time dependent. Now the way that it rotates with time is that it rotates with times like so, and that generates rotation and time Hamiltonian. And you have asked to solve this Hamiltonian, and this Hamiltonian is the same as solving this time independent Hamiltonian. Where phi is simply e to the minus I omega L times T times phi. So once I go into the rotating frame, the system is now topless shifted, or it gains this amount of energy. So it has great desire, if it possible, to minimize this energy, or take advantage of that energy. So let's look at this particular term, and this term looks something like omega cross into R times the current, which is this object. And this is nothing but the velocity. If I look at this internal spinner, is this is an object like so times the density. And this, remember that this is precise. This is what I call the. If I write psi is equal to some square root of n, instead of writing this spinner as 100, now I allow it to rotate in space. And so in general, it is of this form, where this is the unit spinner. So the system is able, but it cannot do very much with the density. But then, if you can change the orientation of the spinner, and then you can gain energy here. So that's the and that's the origin of gaining this energy. There might be another even more transparent way of looking at it. For example, if you write this term, and you can complete the square, and then or you can write in terms of something which is more familiar. And some constant. Now, if you write in this form, that means that there's not much degrees of freedom here to lower the energy. But here, if one can find a way to lower this energy with a total square, then the system would do so. And the way to do it is that to make use of this spin part, and you can rewrite this in terms of if you write in terms of the phi field and then factor out the spinner field, then you get out something like this. In other words, that by varying the spinner field, then this term, this spinner field can cancel this term such that the whole thing will go to zero. So for those of you who are who have been playing with the Trans-Simon theory, instead of doing a singular gauge transformation, one achieves a singular gauge transformation by spin rotation, and that's what is happening. So that is what I have to say about the large spin bosons. Then I will just say a few words about the fermions. Then I'll be. I expect that if I rotate this at over critical frequency, the whole thing begins to fan out. That's the phenomena. And the origin of this is the Barry's phase. One would like to take advantage of the Barry's phase to lower the energy. And it is not only a property of, actually a property of quantum ferromagnets magnets in general. This is only one of the realization of it.
So it looks like the whole system is one term.
It's a one extended, it's a one extended object, so. It can put this gun in your pocket. Now let me now come to the case of fermions, and this is the work that I've done with Songkit Yip, and I'm going to give you a very qualitative argument. In case you don't believe any of these arguments, then you should ask Songkit for all the details. So the And in particular, I'm interested in the phenomena of pairing. Suppose the pairing takes place, and what kind of pair that I will be getting. Now, before I do that, let me remind you some of the things that you people are very familiar with, at least to condensed matter physicists. For electrons, for helium-3, for electrons, the spin 1/2 particles, and then I have a so-called S-wave pairing, or I consider the system condensed a single pair. Now, the quantity of interest is the pairing of a pair of particles in opposite side of the Fermi surface, or the two different time reverse states. And so I'm looking at an object of this form, and usually it is an anti-symmetric matrix, so it's okay. Now, for S wave, for L equals 0, delta k is 1, and for L equals 2, and delta k is just something like this. There's a linear combination of y2m. Now the question is, for L equals 2, is that which one is going to be best? Is it going to be y2, y2, 0, or just a linear combination of them? And that has to be determined by energetics. And just for later discussions, a very useful representation, which may be familiar to people in helium and may not be familiar to people outside helium, is that it's useful to represent the harmonic, second harmonics in the rectangular form, so that I can write it as a dij or kikj. And it seems it has to be, because of the second power, but since it has to be a spherical harmonic, so it has to satisfy Laplace's equation, so then the condition is that this is symmetric, but it's chase also zero, and so on. So that's the now to answer the question again, I'm going back to this case that is familiar. To ask the question that what is going to be the best, then one in has to minimize the free energies usually, then call this matrix. Usually I do something like this, that have minimized energies of this form. Now, in the so-called weak coupling theory, one knows exactly what these coefficients are, and then one just end up with doing a integral of something like this. Now, there's a reason that I don't want to bore you with detail, but there's a reason that I exhibit the structure because would be of use to us later. Then I would have for example, this term we have four b's, and then I have to do the integral over k for a bunch of k's for a of them. And then that is the calculation that one can do, and then you can find out the coefficients, and then you have this energy functional, you can minimize it, and then the outcome turns out to be something like this. The answer is very simple, that the best turns out to be y22. Why y22? Because the y22 turns out to have a maximum gap, and because y22 is only, say, the square of y22 proportional to sine square of theta. And it's only zero at just 2 points, and nowhere is zero. So basically, you try to find a spherical harmonics which has as little zero as possible, and that is the y22. And that, so the in the weak coupling theory, and that is the most favorable the d wave configuration. That's not to say that the high TC is like this because it has a different kind of free energy. Now, what happened to the what happened to the other kind of spins? Now let me consider the case of spin F pairing. But I consider the S wave. So I'm now considering a matrix of exactly the same kind, but of very different nature. I.e., this matrix is going to be independent of K. And then it is a matrix of 2F plus 1 cross 2F. It's a very big matrix. It's anti-symmetric. And I want to find out, I want to go through this scheme to find out what the general structure is going to be. Now, let me just give a simple example. Let me take a two spin 3 halves, and then they would have 0, 1, and 2, and 3. So there's all these are possible total spins you can construct. However, because of the anti-symmetry, I can only this is relevant because all the other ones are these are symmetric states. Only these are anti-symmetric. And then now, if I take 5 halves, and then I have 0, so I have this few states, etc. What I'm going to explain to you now is that there's a deep connection between these two structures. If one can show that for algebra 0, then the let's say the structure of this object, let me just call it new ij, is basically I take two spin f objects and then build up a total zero state. Now, on the other hand, if I go to algebra 2, what one can show that the general structure is the following. Is the CMY2M, which is this object, but then multiplied by eta. And that's turned out the most general structure. And what this spherical harmonic is a spherical harmonic of a function of a spin matrix. Now, what do I mean by spherical harmonics of a matrix? By that, I mean if I write the spherical harmonics in the rectangular form in the previous case, I replace all this spin, all this C number, all these vectors, classical vectors, by the spin operator. So this, in other words, the general form for spin 2 is something like this, FIFJ times the singlet matrix and mu nu. And that's the general structure of the any 2F by 2F anti-symmetric matrix combined into spin 2. Now, immediately, you see that there's a very great strong similarity between these two, except that these are commuting variables, and these two are not commuting variables. And now, if I want to count, in order to determine what's the best pairing structure, I again have to do this calculation in recoupling theory. But now, because of this non-commuting variables, then the structure is going to be very different. Except for one case, they are the same, i.e., in the case of f goes to infinity, these are now become classical variables because f, the commutation 2f goes 1f, so in the limit of large f, they become classical variables. So I know that at the limit where f goes to infinity, or in other words, I pair two 101, of course, there's no. I pair two of these spins, and I want to pair them in the spin 2. Then I would be getting, a structure which is a YC2, which is exactly like those. Now, on the other hand, that so one can do this calculation and go through the calculation, and some kid and I have done it, and then if I calculate all these coefficients, it's a very tedious calculation. But what we have found is the following. There is 3 half here and 5 half here, and then there's 7 half and 9 half, etc. Above this line, some line which is between 5 half and 7 half, and then the best pairing state is YC2, but below it is YC0. And there's a division that divides the there's a critical spin. If I consider spin as a spin as a continuous variable, there's a critical spin that divides the classical type of pairing with the sort of more quantum, well, I don't know what the proper word is, is recovering this everything here is the spin on this side looks like a momentum, classical momentum, and on this side that begin to reveal its quantum nature. Now why now then the question is why is there a difference? You can actually see the difference rather simply. If I go to the most quantum case of 3/2, so in the case of 3/2, then let's say in zero magnetic field I have 4 Fermi surfaces. It's 3/2, 1/2, minus 1/2, and minus 3/2. Now, in order to pair Y22, all I need to do, I can only do this. Because that's the only one I can give out the n equals to 2. So I have only one kind of pairing. Now, if I want to maximize the amount of pairing, then all I get that is there's a lousy way to maximize the amount of pairing. To maximize the amount of pairing, I can pair this and I can pair that, and that will give me a Y20. So now you say, well, why wouldn't this work as I move up? But it turns out as you move up, then the number of ways to pair higher spins also increases. So there's a competition, and there is a phase transition, not phase transition, I don't know what the... So there's a different behavior between 5/2 and 7/2. And that's the... And this behavior is not limited. This just the f equals to 2 is an example, but the argument that we are giving, i.e., on one hand, I know what the answer is, a classical, right? I treat all the spin as a momentum, and on the other side, I can sort out so roughly what the structure is. So that this behavior works for all spin sectors. So it's I believe about general behavior. So that's finish my discussion of some of the key features of pairing, and I don't think I should take any more time. Let me, at the end, show one more time, violating David's rule of the BEC, and I think in the future, hopefully in the near future, there will be more and more quantum lattices experiments that will give us more of the condensed matter models. And at the moment, there's a task force at JILA headed by Deborah Jean to produce fermions. And the way that she does it is to use fermion boson mixtures and then let the boson cool the fermion and eventually try to produce a fermion systems. So hopefully sometime soon, and we could have some system which has exhibited some of these interesting phenomena. Thank you for your attention. According to, let me quote Peter, you can do anything you want, i.e. you can, I think depending on the laser, you could, certainly let's say you can have at the moment the largest cloud has 10 to 6 atoms, and certainly you can produce the use of 10 to the minus 4, that's a wavelength, you could produce a system 10 to the 6 atoms. And it's not 10 to 23, yes, but it's pretty good. Yes, in fact, Peter has demonstrated, in fact, in his studies that it has exhibited, of course, at the moment, the trap that we have has a harmonic trap, and then Peter has shown that the general behavior of this system looks very much like what is expected by the theoretical calculation for the homogeneous model. So yeah, the experiment hasn't been done yet, but I think the theoretical calculation pretty convincing, and it's an exciting situation, especially from my people point to put fermions in the system. So,
what are the prospects of actually looking experimentally then at these spin systems? I mean, an optical trap has
I think at the moment, my understanding at the moment, everyone trying to get one of the rays between two groups in JELA Eric Cornell and Deborah Jeans, they both want to get fermions in potassium. I think it's pretty isotropic. The problem would be that there's an Earth's magnetic field which is pretty large. I mean, you expect to polarize something. You expect to polarize the systems. However, when I talked to Eric and also a number of other experimentalists, one of the suggestions is that because the system is spin conserving, so you can produce artificially a condition that has a zero field. For example, you can have two clouds of opposite directions at the beginning with, and then you turn on an optical trap to trap them, and then you turn on the two clouds originally sitting on a magnetic trap, so that and then you switch on the optical trap to trap the whole thing, and then you turn off the magnetic field. Now when you turn off the magnetic field, then total spin is still zero, and the system cannot relax, so basically you're seeing an effective field which is zero. Now where is this unrealistic? The answer is no, because that is what the first MIT experiments is. I mean, the first MIT experiments, they were desperate. They just want to do anything to produce a condensate. They know that at the center there's something terrible. It's a big leak. So what they do, they put in a laser to plug the hole, and then they produce two wells, and then in the two wells, the magnetic field is like this. So they actually have a two spin. It's like this. So that is in fact a situation that you have a system which is zero total spin, or very close to zero total spin. So that was a method that Eric was suggesting me, that you can get, for example, even though your system has a large magnetic field, the field is in fact very large, but then you can produce just artificially, make it lock into a zero field situation.